Good morning, everyone. How are we all doing today? Good? You always keep saying that, and I ask myself, what am I here for then? When you go to the doctor, and the doctor asks you, how are you doing? And you say, I'm doing fine. Then the doctor's going to ask you, why did you bother coming then? Right? So you brought a crystal ball today for me. What do you want me to do? Tell your future? I think you already know your future. Don't you? Don't you know your future? I think you do know your future. You want to try and change that, I think. That's why you've come here. You know your future. I can give you a crystal ball if you want. Something like that. Would you like a crystal ball? So you can prophesy the future? So you can tell what's going to happen? It is called the law of cause and effect. It is called Paticca-samuppada. That's a crystal ball. You can look at it or look through it and you can tell the future. Often people ask me, how did the Buddha foretell the future? What special power did the Buddha have to be able to foretell what was going to happen? All he did was he used his wisdom. He could look at the karmic energy that each of us has. He understands what causes and conditions have to align for a particular effect to take place. That is his understanding of the Dhamma. And once you're armed with these two things, anyone can tell the future. See, the Buddha was never a wizard. The Buddha was not a magician. He didn't perform tricks. He's not a trickster. He's a scientist. He was a scientist in a robe. That's what the Buddha was. He didn't create or invent anything. So he was not an inventor. He discovered. He realized. Under the Bodhi tree, he realized. He didn't create or invent the Four Noble Truths. He realized them. And that is why the next Buddha will do exactly the same. See, if you invent something, it's unique. If you invent something, it's unique. No one else will be able to invent the same. But I can tell you one thing about two Buddhas who will come one after the other. The Four Noble Truths that they will proclaim will be identical to the letter. It will be exactly the same thing. So even if you wait a while and you think that my time's not this time, my time's going to be the next Buddha's time, well, I'm sorry to burst your bubble. It will be the same old news. It's the same story. It's been the same story so many times over. The same story. It's always been the same truth. Plenty of Buddhas have come and gone. They've all shared the same truth. So you'll have to wonder, how come you and I are still in samsara? Have you not heard the song? Nivan dakinnata. What comes after that? Ping madhi vennati. Ekai tavamat sansara. Loosely translated, it means to attain Nibbana, what we lacked were sufficient merits. As we lacked sufficient merits, we didn't have the power of wisdom. We might have been intellectuals. We'd have been able to compute things, understand the world. Learn how to tie our shoelaces. That's no simple task, believe me. To learn to tie your shoelaces is quite a complicated task. It requires dexterity. A lot of skills. But then what we didn't have was merits. And because we were lacking in merits, the Buddhas, they came in, they preached the Dhamma. They showed us a path, but we were blind. And because we were blind, it mattered not what path was shown to us and how clearly the path was shown to us. Can you see this? What am I showing you? My finger. But what number would this be? 1. Is it clear to everyone? I'm showing you 1. Okay, close your eyes for a second. What number is it now? It's just as clear as it was before. What number is it now? You can't tell. Why? Because your eyes are closed. All right, you can open your eyes now. See, the message was just the same. The same message. I didn't move my finger. It was just there. But once I asked you, before you said it, and then the second time I asked you, you couldn't. Only because you had your eyes closed. So this is what the Buddhas do. They come in and they tell us, they teach us, they show us the path. But if we have our eyes closed, then we can't see. And when we can't see, it matters not how good the guide is. We just can't follow. That's why they say, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. The teacher is always there. The teacher is always there. But when the student is ready, the student opens their eyes. And then it looks like that's when the teacher arrived. It seems like that's when the teacher arrived. No, the teacher was always there. What did the Bodhisattva do? Over so many eons, the teacher was always there. But on the occasion in which the Bodhisattva became the Buddha, at that point, the student was ready. He was ready. What he did over a long period of samsara was to acquire enough merits to finally open his eyes. And then he said, now I have just realized. The truth was always there. It was staring at him in his face. So, and that's exactly what we're here to do as well, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not here to teach you anything that you could not discover yourselves given enough time. I can promise you that. I'm not here to teach you anything that you can't discover by yourselves given enough time. What do I mean by that? If you all want to carry on and one day become a Supreme Buddha, you can all discover this for yourselves. So I'm not here to teach you anything that you can't discover by yourselves. I'm only here to make that journey a little bit shorter for you. Actually, not a little bit, a great deal. That is what the Buddhas do, and that's what the Noble Companions do. They make that journey a little bit shorter for us. If you're in a maze, could you not eventually come out of it? If there was an exit and you're in a maze, it matters not how complicated the maze is, right? If you try out all the different paths, eventually you will come out of it. But if you have a guide who's walked themselves out of that maze before and they know their way around, then they can hold your hand, or at least they can tell you, left here, right there, straight ahead, stop, turn around. Those instructions will simply make it easier for you to walk out of the maze, and it'll save you a great deal of time. And it'll save you a great deal of dead ends. That's what it'll save you. And with dead ends come frustrations. Aren't you frustrated sometimes? That's because you hit a dead end. That's because you didn't have a proper guide. That's because you made a wrong turn. That's because you made a wrong choice. That's why you end up frustrated. That's why you end up disappointed. That's why you end up annoyed. That's why you have some unhappy days in your life. This is the secret behind long nights and sleepless nights. That's why your eyes well up and you start crying when you hit a dead end. When you feel like you're in despair. When it seems like no matter what choice you have available to you, none of them is going to be the right answer for you. There are times in life you'll feel that way. Just imagine if you're in a marriage and it's really not working out for you, but you have your children who need both their mother and their father in their lives. Right? But you're really struggling to get along with your spouse. Now that's a real dilemma, isn't it? Some of you will have been in that situation. So you know what I'm talking about. Some of you may have been in that situation many times. And because you didn't have a guide the first time round, you took that turn again. It's like going round the roundabout. I remember when I used to take driving lessons. When you miss a turn, when you miss your exit, my driving instructor used to say, now you have to go all the way around. So if you miss an exit, you have to go all the way around. That's what happens when you get into a marriage the first time round, and it ends up in a divorce, and you get married again. That's you missing your exit. Now you have to go it all the way around again. I believe in something very deeply. I believe that the greatest gift that man can have is to have a friend who can show you the right path when you have to make a choice in life. When there's a decision that you have to make, these are the decisive points in life. Some decisions we make, ladies and gentlemen, there's no turning back. Am I right or wrong? There are some decisions when you make, then those decisions in your life, it takes a long time to recover. Sometimes maybe an entire lifetime. Then you feel stuck. You feel like you're running, but you're not moving anywhere. You're not going anywhere. You're running, but you're not getting anywhere. Sometimes you feel like that. Sometimes you feel like the ceiling is just up there. If you jump just a little bit higher, you can reach it. And you just keep on jumping. You just keep on jumping. But it's always that much away from you. Just an inch away from you. Sometimes it just feels like the carrot in front of the donkey. You just try to reach it, but it never is within your reach. These are very frustrating times in your lives. I know. I've had my fair share. I didn't fall from the sky. I'm homegrown. Just like each and every one of you. I've had my fair share of ups and downs in my life. I've had my fair share of times where people, I didn't have noble companionship, I didn't have guidance. My parents were there, my friends were there, my teachers were there, but they could only share with me what they thought was right. And unfortunately, they themselves had made some wrong choices, wrong decisions in their lives. What we are here for is to instill within ourselves that moral compass, the right compass. So that whenever you're in this predicament, whenever you're in these dilemmas, you have noble companionship. You have a compass that you can hold and it will always point you in the right direction. Always. Today, I have a compass that always points me in the right direction. Always. Without fail. It's idiot proof. And that's what we're here for. With sufficient merits, and a bit of noble companionship, we can all be empowered with that compass, the compass that always points me in the right direction, so that you never get lost. So that the next time you have to choose between your in-laws and your own parents, you can make the right choice. Sometimes the right choice is neither. That is a choice in itself. Not choosing at all. Someone asks you, do you want to go left here or do you want to go right here? It seems like you only have two choices, but there's a third choice. Choosing neither. See, in life, aren't you always faced with this situation where you have to choose either right or wrong? One choice seems to be right, the other choice seems to be wrong, but what's right for you is not generally right for other people. What seems wrong to you seems to be right for other people, and then you have to work against your own will, and you feel like you're stuck. You don't want to do it because you know it's morally wrong, you know it goes against your values, it goes against your virtues sometimes, but you have to do it because society expects it of you. You have to save face. You have to hold yourself. Your reputation is on the line. In these times, my, these are the tough choices that you have to make in life. And in those times, ladies and gentlemen, you need the Dhamma with you. The Dhamma is your guide. The Dhamma is the way. The Dhamma is the truth. And if you make the right choices, if you make the right decisions at those times, then you'll be glad. You'll be glad that you had your noble companionship, your noble companion with you, because your life will be better for it. As Jesus Christ once said, I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life. To me, there's great profoundness in those words. To me, Jesus Christ is not who you believe Jesus Christ might be. Perhaps you believe he's merely the messenger of God. Perhaps you believe he's merely an entity who was here to share God's message. To me, he's much more profound than that. Because I see him through the lens of Dhamma. One of these days we'll talk about that. Maybe today, maybe another day. We'll see. Like I said last week, there can't be two versions of the truth. If you are ever presented with two versions of something, either one of them is wrong or they're both wrong. Yeah? Either one of them is wrong or they're both wrong. That is possible. Because you can't have two versions of the truth. The truth can only be one version. So if there are many descriptions of what people call the truth, then it is down to us, it is incumbent upon us to make sense of the same truth, no matter what the message is. So it's down to our interpretation. That is why there's a lot of truth to be found in the Holy Bible. There's a lot of truth to be found in the Quran. We'll talk about these things in the future. I'm not here to propagate a religion. I'm not a religious man. But I bring to you the truth. What religion should you be to work that light? If you're in the dark and you want the light on, what religion should you be to flick the switch and get light? What religion should you be? If you want some hot water, you fill up the kettle and you put it on the heater and you turn the fire on, what religion should you be to get some hot water? You know, this is a very silly question because it has nothing to do with religion, right? If you want hot water, then there's a path to take to get yourself some hot water. There's a truth behind getting hot water. You go and study the truth and you heat your water. Science is that truth. So in the same manner, if you want happiness, there's a truth. Nothing to do with religion. And that is why in this audience, we have people of many religions. And we are always very welcoming of that. Because this is not about a religion. This is only my personal opinion. None of the religious leaders that you believe came into this world to proclaim a religion actually came into this world to teach a religion. What they did was they gave the truth. They shared the truth. Later on, people made a religion out of it. You know for what? To segregate themselves. Because they wanted to separate themselves. That's what people love doing. The truth will never separate. The truth will always unite. The truth will never separate. The truth will always unite. I'll give you an example. What is this made of? Oh, well, what is this? It's a leaf, isn't it? It's a leaf. What is this? Oh, what's this? It's a saucer, ceramic. And this is a leaf. What is this made of? Elements, molecules, right? So if you go deep in, you'll find carbons, hydrogens, oxygens, nitrogens. You'll find elements that you'll find in the periodic table. What's in here? Same thing. Once you go down to that level, are these two different things or are they the same? So what has the truth done? Divide or unite? Unite. But if you don't understand that fundamentally these are only the elements and you only see what your eyes can see, if you only look at what your eyes can see, if you can't open your wisdom eye and use your insight and your better understanding of the world to see that these are just the same things but arranged differently, now you think that this is a leaf and this is a saucer. And they're different. So why do Buddhists think that they're any different to Muslims? You have the answer. Why do Christians think that they're any different to Muslims? Why do the Hindus think they're different to Jews? Like I tell you, I'm not here to talk to you about religion. I'm here to open your eyes to the truth. Once you see the truth, you will realize that you are not different to the person sat next to you. And then all these differences that you start seeing, all these differences that you see today, how you are different to another human being, because of your race, because of your creed, because of your religion, because of your social background, all of those differences will just fall apart. And then you become a human being. You become a man of the earth. You become nature. You become one with nature. All of God's things were created equal. All of God's children were created equal. But people don't see it that way today. To me, God is nature. It is the energy that surrounds us. These are my interpretations. So if you don't agree with me, then that's perfectly fine. I'm not asking any of you to agree with me. I'm here to just share with you my opinion. And if there's anything wrong in the way I interpret it, I take whole blame for it. So it's my own interpretation. It's the way I look at the world. We are all entitled to our perspective on how we look at the world. But here's what I can tell you. When I look at the world through this perspective, I'm a happier man. I mean, that's the proof in the pudding. People who like to look at these things as very separate things, how we have so many different religions and those religions set us apart, they are just not happy. So I don't know why they bother. If your religion does not give you happiness, why bother? If you say, I'm a Muslim, and I'm always so miserable, I'll tell you one thing for sure. It's not Islam that you follow. If you say you're a Buddhist, and you're never happy, and you're really annoyed about everything, and you feel like the whole world is out to get you, I'll tell you one thing for sure. That's not Buddhism. If you're a Christian, and all you can see is how everyone is of a different religion. We are Christians and everyone else is different and they're all out to get us. So we have to fight for ourselves. I'll tell you one thing. You are not a follower of Jesus' message. The Prophet Muhammad, Jesus, the Buddha. If they all spoke the same truth, then those who follow in the words of the truth, they must all feel united. But look at the world around you today. Look at the world around you today. How much people separate each other, segregate each other, and draw these boundaries in society. So much so that people forget that we're all human beings at the end of the day. Before seeing that we're all human beings, they first see their religion. Before seeing that we're all human beings, they see what race they are. And what class in society they are. Are they the upper class, the lower class, the middle class? What class do you think I am? Upper class or lower class? What religion do you think I am? Am I a Buddhist? Am I a Muslim? Am I a Christian? Am I Hindu? What religion is this? Tell me. What religion is this? What did I just draw on the board? A chitta. That is the stuff that you're made of. This is the stuff that your mind is made of. This is the stuff your body is made of. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, potassiums. This is the stuff your body is made of. Calciums. What religion are they? Speak up, ladies and gentlemen. Speak up, religious people. Okay, people of the higher class, speak up, will you? What class is this? And if you think you come from the lower class, if you think you come from a low caste, if you believe your family is of the low caste, what caste is phosphorus? Tell me. What caste is phosphorus? What caste is oxygen? Is it high caste or low caste? What religion is carbon? Is carbon a Christian? Is carbon a Hindu? Is carbon a Jew? Or is carbon a Buddhist? What religion is it? I'll have a better question for you. Is it male or female? What gender is hydrogen? Male or female? So that's the stuff your body is made of. This is the stuff your mind is made of. Chittas. What religion is a chitta? What caste is a chitta? What gender is a chitta? The answer is, you're asking the wrong question, Swami. So those questions make no sense. Yes or no? Right. If this is your body and this is your mind, are you anything more than that? You think you are. That's the problem. That is the problem. You think you are more than your body and your mind. Because you create a false identity within your minds. Within yourselves, you create this false identity. And once you create that false identity, now all kinds of falsehood you attribute to that identity. So if you believe you're of a particular religion, that's part of your false identity. If you believe that you are of a particular caste, a particular class, a particular creed in society, then that is part of a false identity. This is what you are. Science will tell you about this. The science of the mind will tell you about this. Here, you'll study about this stuff for physics, chemistry, biology, and so on. In the teachings given by those who have seen the truth, you will study about the mind. That's why I said there can't be multiple versions of the truth. This is the truth, ladies and gentlemen. So if I'm here to teach you about this, and I'm here to teach you about this, what religion am I here to teach you about? You tell me. If I'm here to talk to you about this and I'm here to talk to you about this, what religion am I here to talk to you about? Buddhism? In which case, you must tell me which religion these two things belong to. Do you understand that I'm not a religious man? You know what to do when this suffers. The doctor tells you what to do. People who study these things in great detail, they spend 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years becoming experts in that field. And they tell you the various combinations that this comes in and what to do when these things break, when these things malfunction, the things that are formed out of these things, various combinations. There are various combinations. That's all they are, various combinations. And when those things malfunction, a doctor will tell you what to do. We call them physicians. And there will be plenty of them in the room. When something goes wrong with this, how do you know when something's gone wrong with it? How do you know when something's gone wrong with this? I gave you a couple of examples earlier. When you believe that you're of a particular religion, when you look at me and you think, oh, here's a Buddhist monk. I'm not a Buddhist monk. When you think that you're of a high caste or a low caste, and when people come and tell you, you low caste people, and you feel hurt when people say that? Let people say whatever they want to say. I can't stop people talking and saying things. But I can help you feel. Always feel good. Always be happy. So when something's gone wrong with this, what do? You come to the truth. You go to a class that teaches you Buddhism. Buddhism? No, you go to a class that teaches you the truth. That's why they call the Four Noble Buddhisms. The Four Noble truths. So stop labeling the Buddha as a Buddhist. He's not a Buddhist. He's a scientist. He knows a thing or two about the mind. And he teaches us that. Why are we interested? Because we all have a mind. That's why the pen is not interested in the Buddha's teaching. Because it does not have a mind. So therefore, it is not interested in the Buddha's teaching. But you are supposed to be interested. You have to be interested in the Buddha's teaching. Not because the Buddha was a Buddhist. The Buddha was not a Buddhist. Not in the way that people claim that he was a religious man. He was not a religious man. Yes, he encouraged people to earn merits. He encouraged people to do good deeds. But all good people do that. He explained the reasons behind why he encouraged people to earn merits and do good deeds. And he showed us that when you do good deeds, that creates your karmic energy, which then come back to you as rewards or consequences. He taught you that what you throw away comes back to you. He showed us that life is like a boomerang. What you reap is what you sow. And he explained to you exactly how that happens. In the pages of the Tripitaka, this is what you find. In the Abhidharma, this is what you find. In the Sutta Pitaka, this is what you find. The truth. And that's what we're here to study. That's what we're here to learn. So once and for all, this is not a religion class. This is not religious education. That they might teach you at school. This is not that. This, come here only if you've got something gone wrong with this. If something's wrong with this stuff, go channel a doctor. But if something's wrong with this, come here. I can help. Because when something was wrong with this with me, I came here. And I got help. Now I know what that help is, I can share that with you. That's what we're doing. That's what we're here to do. Does that make sense to everyone? So what religion are we? Cut that out. Stop that nonsense. What caste are you? What creed are you? What race are you? Are you black or white? Is this black or white? Now you'll tell me, Swaminas, that's a black line, so that must be black. That's not what I'm referring to. Is a chitta black or white? Is a chitta Asian or European? Do you have Asian chittas? Indian chittas and Pakistani chittas? So why are they at each other's necks? Do you have Russian chittas and Ukrainian chittas? How about Russian carbons and Ukrainian nitrogens? So why are they at each other's necks? I'll tell you why. Because they create a bit of a nonsense. They create this identity. That's what happens when the chitta goes wrong. When the body goes wrong, you go to the physician. When the mind goes wrong, you have to come to someone who can teach you the truth. And if you don't do that, then that creates this false identity. And this identity is attributed to the various things that people do. I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm an Asian, I'm a European, I'm a Sri Lankan. I'm a Hindu, I'm a Jew, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Christian. This is all in this little fake identity that you create in your own mind. The truth is, you're none of that. You are simply a chitta arising in a ball of all of this stuff. Wouldn't the scientists agree with me? If I explained that to Isaac Newton, Would you not agree with me? If I had explained this to Sir Isaac Newton, would he not agree with me? If I explained this to Einstein, would he not agree with me? Because you understand them as revered scientists, right? Of the modern day. They would. We have to be free thinkers. You can't just be thinking the way that your grandmother asked you to think. Because, you know, there are some things that your grandmother taught you, they were right. But there were equally some things that were wrong. How do you know? I'll tell you how you know. There were times when she was angry. There were times when she was sad. There were times when she was bothered. She was annoyed. That must tell you something. Not everything she knew was right. If you ever come across a man, or a woman for that matter, who's always happy, no matter what, one of two things has to be right. Either they've gone cuckoo. Right? They should be in the mental asylum. Or they've understood a higher truth. And then everything they know is right. So before you take advice from someone, make sure you understand who they are first. Before you take advice from someone, ask yourself the question, are they always happy? Or are there things that bother them? Are there things that annoy them? Do they cry sometimes? Are they unhappy at times? Do you see them disappointed at times? Do you see them annoyed and frustrated at times? Do you see them losing their temper? If they do, then always be prepared to take what they say with a pinch of salt. Because it might be right, it might be wrong. It is down to you to check out everything they say and only take what you say, what you believe is right for you. But if you come across someone who's always happy, no matter the circumstances, even when the whole world is turned upside down, they're still happy. Now you can rest assured that everything they say must be right. And that is the Buddha. That is who the Buddha is. He was always happy. He was never unhappy. Nothing could bother him. Nothing could annoy him. Nothing could upset him. No physical ailment could upset him. It couldn't take away his mental happiness. Therefore, we know that everything he said has to be right. And what we are here to do is to create Buddhas within each and every one of you, so that you're always happy, no matter what the circumstances. And if you can do that, then you will become a messenger of the truth. And what a great place that would be, to become a messenger of the truth. It's what I'm here to do, to share with you the message of the truth. So, before we continue, and before I lose track, and before I forget that I'm also a Buddhist monk, who has to precept you before we continue with the sermon. Let us bring our palms together, knowing why we do that. Let us bring our palms together, knowing that we are here to understand the truth. It is to the truth you make this veneration. That is what the Buddha is. The Buddha is synonymous with the truth. And that is to whom? Actually, it's not to whom. It is to what you bring your palms together. So, let us bring our palms together in veneration of the great teacher, the great master, the truth, as he unfolded it for us and laid it bare for all of us to walk and attain the ultimate bliss of Nibbana.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
When I got back to the monastery, I watched last week's sermon a couple of times. I liked it a lot. Because I thought the message was quite both simple and profound at the same time. And I want to thank you for that. So thank you. Thank you for the sermon. Now you're thinking, Lahminas has lost his mind. He did the sermon, he's coming here and thanking us for the sermon. Those who know what I mean, know what I mean. Can anyone in this room take full credit for the sermon? Anyone in this room take full, total credit for the sermon? No. Because who did the sermon? Who did the sermon? No one did the sermon. A sermon happened. A sermon happened. What's happening right now? A sermon's happening. If you all left this room right now, do you think I'd continue speaking? Even if I did, it would not be the same sermon. It would not be the same words. I would not be using the same examples. Because the environment is what draws the vipaka to create an effect. So there's not a single person in this room who can take full credit for the sermon, including myself. The sermon happened. And I like that sermon because, as I said, it was both simple and profound at the same time. Because we talked about comforts and we talked about happiness and how the two things are not one and the same. Let me draw something on the board. You tell me which one it is. The reason I'm revisiting this topic is because there are a few more things I'd like to share with you on that. And at the same time, it's when you don't understand the difference between these two, you sacrifice your happiness for the sake of comforts. But the irony of that is, you want your comforts because you believe it makes you happy. Now tell me, what is this? Comfort or happiness? Is it a comfort or is it happiness? It's a comfort. I've drawn a car. Oh, there may be those here who are first timers. First timers, give me a show of hands, please. If you've not even listened to the sermons online, very first time you're here. Yes? Okay, welcome. Welcome to the family. You won't be strangers for very long. This is a comfort. Money can buy you comforts. People think money can buy them happiness. That's the problem. Because they think comforts... this is what people think. They think comforts equal happiness. So they think more comforts equals more happiness. And then they ask themselves, how can I get more comforts in my life? Comforts come with a price tag. Can you all see the board? Is it up on the display? Okay. Those at the back of the room, what have you just drawn here? Okay, you can't see. I can't see it either. I'm not supposed to anyway, so that's all right. Comforts equal happiness is what people believe, and comforts come with the price tag. If you want to check whether something's a comfort or a happiness, ask yourself some really simple questions. Does it come with a price tag? If it does, it cannot be happiness. Like I tried to convince you last week, I have not a penny to my name, but I'm a very happy man. So happiness does not come with a price tag. Because if it did, I wouldn't be able to afford it. Not without a penny to my name, I wouldn't be able to afford it. I can't afford a car though. I give you that. I can't afford a car. So thankfully when I said sadhu kare denna, and the rest was history. But I can't afford a car. I couldn't afford a car. I can't afford a house. I can't even afford a robe. I can't afford any of those things because they come with a price tag. But happiness luckily doesn't come with a price tag. I need you to understand this and really make this your religion if you want it. If you want a religion, make this your religion. Today, people's religion is money. People think making money is their religion. People who've lost people who've lost in touch with Christianity, people who've lost in touch with Islam, people who've lost in touch with Hinduism, people who've lost touch with Buddhism, because they all speak of a truth. To whatever degree the religious leaders were able to proclaim the truth, to that degree people understand and they follow the truth. But those, today we live in a world where we are very commercialized. And by which I mean people are all going after comforts. Because what do you have in a commercial world? Transactions. What do you transact? Value. Is there any intrinsic value in a piece of metal? Is value something that is intrinsic? If value is something intrinsic, how can you negotiate? Just the very fact that you can negotiate the price of something proves to you that the value is not in the object, isn't it? People negotiate the price and the value of all sorts of things. Cars. In some cultures, when you want to give your daughter's hand in marriage, what do they negotiate? The dowry. So what's the value in? Is the value in the daughter? But parents fall for this. Young people fall for this. So I tell you, you know, if ever someone comes up to you and offers the dowry in exchange for your daughter's hand or exchange for your son's hand in marriage, bring that poor sod to me and let me talk to that guy. Because they're after comforts, they're not after happiness. Don't be a mother or a father who sells their child to another man or a woman when they're willing to exchange a dowry for your son or daughter because they see your child as a comfort. And what happens when people see something as a comfort? They use it. They use it. They use it for as long as they can make use of it. And when they cannot, they abuse it. And then once they're done with it, I told you what they do last week in last week's sermon. What people will do to you once they have used you. Now that's the part I said we should take out of from the online sermon, remember? Don't make me have to repeat it. Like a tissue paper, they throw you away. So if someone walks up to you and says, can I have your daughter, your son's hand in marriage, and here's how much money I'm willing to offer for that. Here's how much land I'm willing to offer for that. Don't sell your child. Bring that child to me. And I will show them real happiness. But here's what people think. They think comfort equals happiness. So here's what they do. They expend happiness to try and achieve comforts. I'm going to show you that this is a vicious cycle. And you're actually spending happiness that you already have in the hope that you can achieve more comfort, which will eventually bring you happiness. let's go back to the basics. I've drawn a car here on the board, and you all agree that this is a comfort, not a happiness. But if you ask most people why they buy a car, most people will tell you, it's because it makes me happy. Most people will tell you that. Because to get from A to B, you don't need a particular type of car, do you? As long as it's safe, as long as it's drivable, as long as you pump the fuel into it and it takes you safely, right? And if you turn left or go, the vehicle goes left and not right. That's a good enough vehicle. It's a mode of transport to get you from A to B. But just look outside. As you drive up on the streets, just look at all the different types of vehicles that people drive. Sometimes you see, you know, vehicles the size of ships, and there's only one person driving in it. Got nothing against that. But here's what I have a problem with. This. I've got nothing against them owning the car. What I have a problem with is them thinking that a bigger car gives him more happiness. That's wrong. And to get a bigger car, to get a luxury car, to get a more expensive car, here's what they'd have to do. Oh, and here's what they would have done. They would have expended happiness. They would have expended happiness to earn some dollars which would have gotten them the car, in the hope that the car will eventually bring them happiness again. You've got to see that they've lost the plot somewhere along the way. Right? Let me draw it clearly for you again. Everyone wants happiness. Everyone wants happiness. Someone tells them that you can be happy if you bought a car. So now this is the dream that they have. They want a car, because they believe the car will bring them happiness. But you go to the showroom and the car comes with a price. So now they have to earn money. They have to either borrow money, earn money, make money, steal money, do something. Do something to get the money to get the car. What they have, when you are born, you only have one thing. Well, you have your bodies and you have your minds. Happiness is something that is by default in the mind. This is what we talked about last week. You don't need to do anything to be happy. Happiness is yours. It comes as part and parcel of a chitta. Because happiness is a chitta without suffering. That's it. If you have a pure chitta, there's nothing additional you have to do to make the chitta happy. A chitta is happy. That's it. But here's what people do. You spend many of these to earn some of this. Take it in a very simple sense as well. Don't you leave your families and go and work 9 to 5? Would you rather be with your family or would you rather be at work? A simple question. Because work, I mean, family is the people you love to be around. That's where your home is, that's where your heart is, right? Family is who you love to be around. But you leave your families at home and you go and work. Because work earns you money. Why do you need money? So you can buy comforts. Why do you need comforts? Because you believe it brings you happiness. So what are you really doing? You're expending happiness to earn money, to buy comforts, which you believe brings you happiness. But this is wrong. Comforts don't bring you happiness. You already have happiness with you. You're spending happiness that you already have to buy comforts which you believe will bring you happiness. Haven't you drawn the short straw? See, there's a flaw in this thinking, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to step outside of that. Think outside the box. I need you to step outside of this thinking. Just take a walk down the way you've lived the last few years of your life. Take the last 20 years, 30 years, the last 40 years of your life. Much of it would have gone to earning a lot of this. Much of it. Right from your education, higher education, then getting yourself experience, getting yourself into work, and then moving up the career ladder. the next promotion after the next one, going places, getting to know people, finding influential people in society so that you can make a good network with, bond with, connect with, so that they can get you into places which you would not otherwise have been able to get into. I was in the corporate world, so I understand how it works. So when you invite someone for a drink, it's not just for a drink. It's for a drink and then some. The drink just gets the conversation started. Because they say in the corporate world, it's not what you know, it's who you know. So you have to find the who's who know how to get you the dollars, so that they can get you the comforts that you think is going to get you the happiness that you so deserve. But unfortunately, you're expending your own happiness, which you already have with you, to earn a comfort which is never actually going to give you happiness. I'll give you an analogy. Imagine you are traveling the desert. In fact, I'm borrowing this story from a Jataka tale. It's called the Apannaka Jataka. It's the very first Jataka tale in the 550 Jataka stories. If you ever get a chance, you can read the book. Now I'm going to relate it to you in a way that you can understand it. So I'm going to narrate it to you in a way that you can relate to it, right? Imagine you're stuck in the desert and you had some water with you. Say you had a barrel of water and you're carrying it in your... You're in a cart and you're carrying it with you. You have a barrel full of water. It's a barrel full of water. It's good drinkable water. That's actually what's in it, but someone was playing a practical joke on you. So instead of the sticker that had water on it, here's what they did. They took the sticker off and they put something like this on it. That's the best I can do. That's a skull. Okay, that's a skull. Please nod in agreement. Thank you for being courteous. So they took out the water sticker and they put that on there to imply that what's in here is deadly. They were just playing a practical joke on you. So now you're in the desert. Now you didn't know this. You thought it was water in there. And then while now you're in the desert, it's hot. It's the sun is scorching and you want a drink. And so you stop and you walk up to the barrel to get some water. And then you see that there's a sticker on it. All the while you thought that was water. But now you realize, or you at least think, that this is poison. Are you going to drink it? No, because you can't risk it. Because now you think it's poison. So now that you think it's poison, you're not going to drink this. Here's what happens next. You come across some bandits. These are mugglers, if you like. They're in the desert. They camp in the desert. They wait for innocent travelers, naive travelers, travelers who are willing to engage in conversation with them. And you come across these bandits, and what they do is they tell you, well, you can just throw all this away because we have some good water that you can drink. And they offer that water. So they also have some barrels. They have some barrels with them. But that is actual poison. They tell you, this is water. If what you have is poison, just throw it away and we'll give you poison. No, sorry, we'll give you water. If you believe their word and you discard and throw away all the water that you have, and then you take the poison that they give you and fill your barrel up with it. Make sense? So you have good drink of the water in here, you throw the water away, and you fill it up with the poison that they're now giving you. What would you call yourself? Someone who does that, what would you call yourself? A wise man. What would you call yourself? Huh? A what? A fool. Okay. If you say so. If you say so. A fool, right? Okay. Let me write it up here so you can all see it clearly. Just in case. So, someone who throws away the good water that they have, the good drinkable water that they have that could quench their thirst and save them in the desert, who throw that away and in its stead take the words of a cunning, conniving murderer, a bandit, a burglar, a thief, and fill their barrel up with the poison that they have to offer. Because they know what you're going to do next. You're going to drink that, and then a few yards ahead, you're going to drop dead. Someone who does that has to be a fool. They cannot be a wise man. Agreed with me? Do you all agree? Anyone disagree? Speak now or forever hold your peace. Because I have something interesting to tell you next. Okay? All in agreement? Right, let's proceed then. Right, that's recorded on camera. You all agreed, okay? Oops, sorry, let's put that back. We'll need that for the future. Right? Now, you're all born with God's gift. These are chittas. A mind that is by default happy. Okay? By default, a chitta is happy. In other words, you are born happy. You are born happy, ladies and gentlemen. But here's what you do. You take on views, we've now coined a phrase for that. You become drushtified. Yes? You are drushtified by the associates that you have, the ignoble associations that you have. People who tell you that to be happy, you have to acquire many comforts in life. This is what people tell you. Start making a mental list of all the comforts you have at home right now. Just make a mental list of some of the things you have. The things that you have today surrounded yourself with. These are the things that people would have told you you need in your life to be happy. The latest gadgets. That's why every year when the new iPhone comes, what do people do? They queue outside the store, sometimes for days, if not weeks. Have you not seen this? What happens when the next Xbox comes? Young children, they queue outside. When they say something's on sale, there are people, men, women, queuing outside stores just to buy it while it still lasts. There are some restaurants, people stand outside in long, lengthy queues. I mean, you should look at a Dhansal. On a Vesak day or a Poson day, have you seen those queues? Like for an ice cream. I mean, all credit to those who give the dancer. But what about the people queuing outside sometimes for many hours for an ice cream? It's like they've never had ice cream in their lives before. Somehow that ice cream is special. Why? Because it comes for free. You know, there's nothing in life that is free. People don't understand that. But they queue outside the ice cream dancer waiting for that special ice cream which is free. All the while, what are they spending? Happy chittas. They're spending happy chittas. They'll queue outside Pizza Hut. They'll queue outside KFC. They'll queue outside Burger King. They'll queue outside all sorts of places. They'll queue outside the boutique stores. They'll queue outside the fashion stores. They'll queue outside the showrooms. They'll queue outside all sorts of places in the hope that they can achieve comforts which they believe bring them happiness. This is a big fat lie. That is the trap that we've all fallen into. You fell into this trap, ladies and gentlemen, because this is what ignoble associations left you with. People gave you all sorts of lies. Look at the watch that's on your wrist right now. It's a branded one, isn't it? It's a good watch, isn't it? Where did you get it from? Pamunua? It's not 500 rupees. It's at least 50,000 rupees. And the further into Colombo we go, the number of zeros at the end of that keep adding up. And if you go further into Colombo, it'll not be 50,000, but 500,000. Oh, there are watches you can buy for hundreds of thousands of rupees. Sorry, I'm teaching you to suck eggs here. You should be telling me this stuff. But someone told me. Swami said, did you know that there are watches you can buy for 250,000 rupees? I was like, what? I was thinking to myself, how many books we could buy for the school? How many uniforms we can sew for the children that we have at the monastery for 250,000 rupees? People put a wristwatch for that amount. But the 500 rupee one and the 250,000 rupee one, they both tell the same time. They both tell the same time. Oh, but then you can have atomic clocks, can't you? Time clocks that are so accurate, they synchronize themselves with atomic time. What, so that you can be so punctual? So that you're not even an atomic second late. No, you never needed that wristwatch. What you wanted was the recognition that came because people told you that if you had more comforts around you, right, then you display that you are a happy person. This is how people indoctrinated you. You know, it's fine. You know, those are mistakes of the past. I admit, right? I've made a few and fair of my own mistakes. It's time we learn from our mistakes. That's all. This is not me showing you and pointing out the mistakes that you've made in your life, so that you have to now go cry in a corner, or go and hide under your bed. I don't go and stick yourself in a cave somewhere until you die. That's not what this is for. This is just so that we can learn from our past mistakes. These are some of the things we did. We went after comforts because people told us the more comforts you have, the more happy you are. Yes or no? Didn't people tell you the more friends you have, the happier you could be? Didn't someone ask you one day, who's your best friend? Someone would have asked you this. Otherwise, you know, there was no need to have a best friend. But someone asked you, who's your best friend, Buddha? Is a best friend? Yeah, you need to have a best friend. Don't you have a best friend? I don't have a best friend. You need to get a best friend. So then amongst your friends, you had to separate someone who was your best friend. And now what you did was you handed over your happiness to that person. So if they considered someone else their best friend, you weren't happy. Weren't you asking for trouble? Because a friend is also a comfort. A friend is not happiness. Happiness is not something anyone or anything can offer you. So as I said, look at the wristwatch on your arm, on your wrist, right? And answer this question for me. Whenever you have that wristwatch on your wrist, You are never unhappy, are you? You're always happy when you have that wristwatch on your wrist, aren't you? You're never angry, you're never upset, you're never disappointed, you're never frustrated, you don't get annoyed when you have that 250,000 rupee wristwatch on your hand. You're never annoyed, are you? You're never unhappy, right? You're always happy, right? Because that is a happy watch. But I mean, come on, that's what you bought it for. Because they said, spend the dollars, you get the comfort, and the comfort brings you happiness. So whenever you have that watch on your arm, you should always be happy. Right? So you are, aren't you? What about that chain that you have? The necklace? The chain? Or the bracelet? Those lovely earrings that you wear? The anklets and the bracelets and all this, that fancy jewelry that you wear and you have at home? When you wear that, now you are fully dressed, you dress yourself up and you go to a party. Right? Other times you keep it in your drawer, fair enough. Right? But when you go to a party, right, you really do yourself up, don't you? You do your hair, you do your makeup, you put on your best and finest jewelry, right? You get yourselves in the nicest and the finest clothes that you can find. These are the things that are supposed to bring you what? Happiness, right? So when you are clad in all that, and when you have you're adorned in all your jewelry, you're happy, aren't you? You're always happy then, right? So in that moment, if someone were to kill you, that would be fine, wouldn't it? Because you'd have a happy death, wouldn't you? So really, by those terms, a bride and a bridegroom should never have tears in their eyes. Because the bride is dressed their best on the wedding day. That's the best they've ever been dressed. So they should not be unhappy on that day. But if you've been there and you know what I'm talking about, so you're always looking out from the corner of your eyes. Is someone trying to outsmart you? Someone's trying to outlook you? Is there competition in the audience? Is there anyone giving furtive glances towards my groom? Right? Who's seeing each other? Who's looking at each other? Who's going out with each other? You're always scanning the room. But you're supposed to be happy. And if things don't go to plan, if there are delays, then you're bothered, you're annoyed, you're angry. If the kapamata doesn't arrive on time, then? If the drummers don't arrive on time, and when you're a couple of seconds away from the auspicious time and people are still not ready to perform the ashtaka, then? But you're dressed in your finest, the things that people said were going to give you happiness. So when you're dressed in your finest, how can you be unhappy, at least in those times? You cannot be, if that were true. But the truth is, comfort does not equal happiness. This is such a salient point. That's why I'm going over this again with you, ladies and gentlemen, because I know this is where one of the places where you get stuck. In your comfortable lives that you live, this is one of the areas where you really get stuck, because you fall for this. No, the truth is you have fallen for it. Where you think happiness equals comfort. These things, they come with a price tag. How many of these have you spent to earn a lot of this? Let's take a count. 13 years of school. At least. Then? 3 years of university at least? That's 19 years. Sorry, 16 years. You don't stop there. Then you have to, because with that you can get a basic job, a starter, on a starter salary. But that's not enough, because it's not enough just to have a car. You need to have a good car. a nice car. It's not enough just to have a house, you need to have a nice house. Why? Because the more comforts you have, the more happy you are. That's what people tell you. That's why I compared my life to the life that many lay people live today, and I said, I don't have any of those things I drew on the board last week, but I'm happy. And that is because happiness does not come in these things, but you have fallen into the trap. You have been sold a big fat lie. My task here is to help you realize that happiness is contained within your own self. It's in your chitta. You need not work hard for your happiness. Happiness is there with you right now. Otherwise, people take you for a fool. Are you okay with that? They take you for a fool. They're taking you on a ride. Are you okay with that? How many of these must you spend to earn one of these? Let's just say you work in a good, a well-paid job, right? Say, just for argument's sake, right? Let's say you earn 50,000. Sorry to insult you. Most people probably be offended. just for argument's sake. Let's just say you earn 50,000 a month. How many happy chittas did you spend earning that? Let's work out the math. Right, 9 to 5. How many hours is that? 8 hours. Yeah? How many days per week? 5. 5 days a week, times by 5, you have 40 hours. 40 hours a week, times by 4. For the 4 weeks, now you have 160 hours. 160 hours of what? Actually, these are not 160 hours. You're counting it in wrong terms. It's not hours that you spend. What are you spending? Happy chittas. You spend happy chittas. And how many chittas can you fit in 1 second? How many happy chittas can you fit in 1 second? Many millions. Let's just say it's a million. A million happy chittas in 1 second. Just for argument's sake, let's say it's 1,000. 1,000 happy chittas in 1 second. We are talking about 160 hours of time, or rather, happy chittas spent over the course of a month so that you can earn yourself 50,000. What do you do with the 50,000 after that? Now you already spent happy chittas, right? Now what do you do with the 50,000? You have to go shopping to spend your 50,000. So you go shopping. You go to the mall and you walk around. Like you look at different things and you ask, do you have it in different color? Do you have it in different size? And you try on things. Do you enjoy trying on, fitting on things and taking them off? I don't know. Some people do apparently, but I don't know why. But people do. Fair enough, right? So you just keep doing that. All the while you're still spending what? Happy chittas. So you've already earned the 50,000. Right? For that you've already spent 160 hours, but the dress that you want to buy is not yours yet. You have to get to the store. So for that you have to drive your car, and for that you have to put fuel into it. You get to the mall, you park the car, that takes you at least another 2 hours or so, at the very least, and then you're walking around the store, looking for what you want to buy, which is another few hours there. All the while you're spending what? Happy chittas. Yeah, you're still spending happy chittas. And then you ultimately find the cloth that you want to buy. You take it to the cashier. You pay some of your 50,000. I'd say you spend 5,000 on that. So you spend 5,000 of money that you earn by spending happy chittas. Then you buy that, you exchange your 5,000 for the dress. They bag it up, they give it to you. Now you have to take it back to the car. You have to get back yourself back home, which is another couple of hours. And then, what do? As soon as you walk home, you go in front of the mirror, you put it on, right? You look at yourself in the mirror, you turn around a little bit, you know, enjoy what you see. And then you ask the people at home, how do I look? And then usually what do they say? That's all right. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it looks nice. Yeah, what's for lunch? They're far too concerned about when the next meal is going to be served. Too busy to be appreciating what, you know, all the time and the effort that you put into try and find something that looks nice on you. Because that doesn't make them happy, because happiness does not come in your dress. If it did, they wouldn't be asking you about lunch. They'd be enjoying your, you know, the sight of what they see. But instead, they're more concerned about when lunch is going to be or when dinner is going to be served. But you're the one who's happy. You're standing in front of the mirror. You look at yourself and you say, no one's appreciating me. Well, at least I must appreciate myself. So you take out your phone. You take a few pictures, a few selfies. Why are you laughing? Does it ring any bells? Oh, good. So you take out your phone, take a few selfies, and then you post them where? Yes, thank you. You put them on that book. Right? And then from then on, what should you do? So you take a few pictures, put it on Facebook, and your phone goes there. And then every time your phone makes an alert, what should you do now? Pick it up and see what people have said. All the comments, all the likes and the shares, right? What are you spending all the while? As you're doing all this, what are you spending? Happy chittas. While you're doing this, you're spending happy chittas. Right, so you do this for about an hour or so, and then you take the dress off and you put it back in the wardrobe. When do you see that again? When does that dress see daylight again? Maybe in a month's time, maybe in a few weeks' time, maybe even never. Now, even if it did, let's say in a week's time you have a party to go to, so you take that dress, you put it on, and now you take it, you put the dress on, and now you're out with friends. Are you looking at your dress? Are you looking at your dress? What are you looking at? Other people. So you don't look at yourself. Do you? I mean, you don't walk around looking like this. Because you've got to see where you're going. You're going to bump into something. Right? So you have to look ahead to see where the electric poles are. You have to see where the road is. Right? You have to see the oncoming traffic. You don't bump into people. So you can't enjoy how you look anymore than when you're stood in front of the mirror. So the only time you could enjoy how you looked in your new dress was when you were in front of that mirror. But what about all those happy chittas that you spent? See, each chitta was an opportunity for you to be happy. But here's what you did. You burdened yourself with those indoctrinations that people placed on your head, and then you carried them around all the while looking for relief, looking for solace. See, you've shot yourself in the foot. This is why the Buddha comes into this world, to teach people, my dear ladies and gentlemen, my dear people, my dear men and women, the Buddha says, please open your eyes and realize that happiness is not something that you have to go looking for outside. Happiness is yours. It's there with you right now. If you fall into the traps that people lay down for you, ladies and gentlemen, you will keep on doing this for the rest of your lives. Take a moment and answer this question for me. How many nice dresses do you have in your wardrobe right now? Just take a mental count. How many dresses do you have in your wardrobe right now? Think about the last time you went shopping. how many things you bought with you, and the time before that, and the time before that, and the time before that. Today you have a wardrobe full of stuff. You hardly use any of it. Most of the time you go out, you know, wearing the same thing. But you have to buy stuff and put them in your wardrobe, and you just keep filling your wardrobe up with stuff. All the while, to buy those things, you spend happy chittas. You can't get them back. Once the chitta is gone, it's gone for good. You can't get it back. These were all opportunities simply to be happy. Because here's what happiness is. It's not comfort. Happiness is knowing that you're happy. That is what happiness is. It's knowing that you're happy. Happiness is being in the present. But you can't be in the present when you put that dress on, because you're now already thinking, what will people say? What will people think of me? See, now you're living in the future. What comments will I get from my friends when I post this on Facebook? See, now you're living in the future. You can't be happy then. Or if someone makes a comment, now you're living in the past. Why did she say it like that? What did she mean by that? Did she want to hurt me? Was she being critical about my dress? Did she not like it? Did he not like it? He didn't even say, make a comment. Now you're living in the past. So you're always living in the past and in the future. You're never in the present. And the present is where the chitta is. There are no such things called future chittas. There are no such things called past chittas. There's always only a present chitta. That's why they're called pachupanna chittas. There are only pachupanna chittas. Chittas that are present in the present. That's all. But here's what happens. When this chitta rises, you create in your mind a third dimension. And in that dimension, you call it the dimension of time. And you create a future, you create a past. So when you go shopping, you can't just enjoy the dress therein that you see in front of you. You have to mentally picture yourself in it with your friends, with your people, at the party. And so you're constantly being critical. When you're critical, you're always comparing something. When there's a comparison, you're not happy. You're sacrificing happy chittas. That's what you do. A chitta is born happy. You don't have to go traveling to enjoy happiness. You know, God is perfect. When He created you, He created you perfectly. When He gave you a chitta, it was perfect. You were born happy. But you didn't accept that. You thought that God did only half a job. That's what you thought. You thought God did half a job. Now I have to go find my happiness. That's where you went wrong. Now, in this room, there'll be people who understand God in many different ways. Do I believe in God? Of course I believe in God. But I have my own interpretation of God, as you do yourselves. To me, God is nature. God is everything. God is the principle of give and deny. Ultimately, that's what God does. G-O-D is that. Give or deny. If you give, you get. If you deny, you are denied. Whatever you give others, you get. Whatever you deny others, you are denied. That's why it is
G-O-D.
Give or deny. When is God good to you? If you deny goodness to others, is God going to be good to you? God believers in the room, answer. I am one. So are you. So God believers in the room, answer. If you are bad to people, in other words, if you deny good to people, is God going to be good to you? Will He? No, He will damn you. He'll send you to hell. But if you are good to people, if you give goodness to others, what will God give you? Goodness. So if you give, you are given. If you deny, you are denied. So do I believe in God? Of course I do. I believe in the principle of give or deny. And you are given or you are denied. So when God created the chitta, when God created you, He created you perfect. You didn't have to go looking for happiness. He created you happy. But you thought that God only did half a job. By you, I mean, I don't mean you individually. I mean just general people. People thought that God did half a job. So what did they think they had to do? Go looking for happiness. So then they went looking for happiness. And in their quest for happiness, they ignored God. They ignored His advice. They ignored His message. And they started to take teachings from other people who were ignorant. Sorry? Yes. Did I not complete the story? Oh, you didn't understand that. Okay, I'll come back to that. Thank you. Sure. Relationship, right. So when God created you, He created you perfect. He created you with a chitta. And that chitta is perfect. You need not go looking for happiness because the chitta was created happy. If ever when you look at something, if the sight of something makes you unhappy, ladies and gentlemen, you have gone against God. You have rejected God. You have not accepted that God has given you happiness. When you look at something, you should be able to look at anything and be happy. But today you have certain things in life that you look at and you're happy, and there are other things in your life you look at and you're unhappy. If I show you a fully blossomed flower, you'll say that makes you happy. But if I show you a rotten apple, you'll say that makes me unhappy. If a fully blossomed flower is a creation of God, what about a rotten apple? Is that not God's creation as well? Is that not God's creation? So would He create something in the world for you to be unhappy? Yeah. By this point, we have many Christians and Catholics in the room as well. So I'm speaking to all people who identify themselves as Christians. Ultimately, there's no such thing. But if you identify yourself as a Christian, then I speak to you as well. If God created you in this world in His spitting image and He wanted you to be happy, if He created you to be happy, would He create something in this world to make you unhappy? If He loves you? Would He? If God, you believe that God loves you, right? He loves you. He loves you unconditionally. So would He create something in this world to make you unhappy? So would He then create a fully blossomed flower to make you happy, a rose flower to make you happy, and a rotten apple to make you unhappy? Would He? He wouldn't do that. So if you're happy looking at the flower, but you're unhappy looking at the apple, that's not God's fault. You've gone against God. You were born happy. You were simply given the gift of thought to look at a flower and recognize it as a flower, and look at the apple and recognize it as an apple, either a good apple or a rotten apple. The emotional response that you get, the pleasure that you experience, and the vexation that you experience when you see one and when you see the other, that's all you're making. God doesn't do that. That's your making. That's your doing. And the problem there is because of ignorance that people have planted in your mind. Because someone somewhere said, someday, flowers, when they're in full bloom, they're lovely. Rotten apples, yuck. Don't look at them. Throw them away. I mean, it's fine. You shouldn't eat a rotten apple, but that's one thing. But if you think that the sight of a rotten apple is disgusting, believe you me, someone put that idea into your head. And that was Satan. God didn't do that. Because both the ripe apple and the rotten apple, they're both creations of God. He doesn't create in this world anything to make you unhappy because He loves you unconditionally. If you disagree with me, then what you're telling me is, no, God doesn't love us unconditionally. He only loves us some of the time. Sometimes He makes us happy, sometimes He makes us unhappy. In which case, I love God more than you. That's not so. Nothing in this world is created to be unhappy. Unhappiness is a creation of your own mind. Unhappiness, sorrow, grief, sadness, these are all creations of your own mind, ladies and gentlemen. There's nothing in this world that is created for man to be unhappy about. Nothing. Because God doesn't do that. He loves you. He doesn't do that. Physically, yes. Physically, yes. But not mentally. This is the gift of God. For those who don't believe in God, here's the next version of the story, the alternative version of that same sermon. In other words, for those who don't believe in God, if you made someone happy someday, some point in the past, today you have been presented with a chitta that is born pure. A chitta that is born pure. A pure chitta does not suffer. Because a chitta is born when eye comes into contact with an object. When the eye is presented with an object, a chitta is born to recognize that. And you know the process. We've talked about it. The five aggregates, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara and vijnana. These are the five aggregates. This is the process that a chitta runs through to recognize an object, to identify an object, and to perceive an object. That's it. Your vexation, your unhappiness, or your happiness, this pleasure that you experience from within you has nothing to do with the object. It's not in the eye, it's not in the object. But when these two things come together, and a chitta is born, a happy chitta, this chitta then takes on the various indoctrinations that it has been given from other people that you have associated. These are the asat purushas, the ignoble friends that you have associated, who've told you that to be happy, there are certain things in life that you have to be able to see, and there are certain things in life that you have to be able to avoid. Like the rotten apple, like the withering flower. The blooming flower makes you happy. The withering flower makes you unhappy. Says who? You know, when you look at your face in the mirror, it makes you happy, doesn't it? I mean, at least you have to be happy. When you look at your face in the mirror, aren't you happy? Don't you think that is the loveliest sight? Now just imagine your face, but just imagine someone throws acid on your face. Right? So someone just throws acid on your face. Maybe they were just throwing it at something and it just fell on you by mistake. But now your face is burnt. Or there's a fire. You get caught in the fire and now half of your face is burnt. Just picture your face like that in the mirror. Just imagine your face, but say half of it is burnt. Either acid, burn, or fire. What do you think about your face right now? If that were the case. It's no longer pretty, is it? Now you say it's ugly. Now you say it's ugly. It's an ugly face. So what might you try and do? Surgery? Plastic surgery? You'll try some way to try and cover it up. You might go to the surgeon and say, please, can you graft some skin maybe and try and, you know, make it, do something to put my face back to what it was earlier, previously. See, your face, I know, of course, when it burns, it hurts, but if you just go past that and now the fire has done the damage, but now, you know, No fire, no acid now, but half of your face is burned. You can't recover that. at this point, your face having the burn, a scalded face, is that also not a creation of God? Is it only a fully formed face that is a creation of God? What about a face who's half burnt? Is that not a creation of God? So who's given you the right to say that that is ugly? You think it's ugly because someone's told you that. Someone's given you this drushti. Someone's given you this indoctrination that a burnt face is ugly. That's why when sometimes you see people on the streets, some people whose skin decays. There are some people who have such conditions, their skin decays. Some people's skin is very rough. They become scaly. There are some people on whose face there's a lot of hair. Now, is it with hair or without hair? A face looks nice. With hair or without hair? Who says so? Let's take the face of a woman. Should it be with or without hair? See, you have an answer, don't you? Who are you to judge? God's creations? That's why you thread your eyebrows. That's why you thread your upper lips. Yes? That's why you remove your facial hair. So, God's creation is imperfect, is what you're saying. So, God created the woman imperfectly. So, He got it wrong. He shouldn't have put facial hair on you, right? So, He was wrong. How dare you? You do it because maybe your mother did it. Your friends did it. Your sister did it. You saw it in a magazine somewhere, and they said that's how you should groom yourself. But you shouldn't have any facial hair. You shouldn't have any body hair. I mean, you know, if you had facial hair, let's say a woman, if she had facial hair, it's not going to get in the way of anything, is it? And if you couldn't eat your food because you had facial hair, yes, I understand that'll be a problem. Right? But if you had a little bit of facial hair, what harm does it do to you? Just imagine a woman with a mustache. See, it makes you laugh. Why does it make you laugh? Because that's not an image that you like to see in your mind. So, because you have accepted this societal norm that women should have no facial hair, all women, from the day that they hit puberty till the end of their life, they have to suffer. Suffer doing what? Grooming themselves. You asked for it. Now go suffer. There are a few women, some in, you know, some parts of the world, they have embraced their facial hair. So then they just feel, you know, this is how God created me, and I'm fine with that. They embrace it. I mean, if it gets in the way of you functioning as a human being, then fair enough. Like if because of your facial hair, you can't eat your food, right? Or it covers your eyes and you can't see where you're going, then fair enough, right? If your eyebrows, you know, grow so long that they cover your eyes, fair enough, right? But, you know, any little bit of facial hair that you might have, it does not get in the way of you doing anything with your life. But to look presentable, because society has created this image of what you need to look like, and that image is the image of beauty, now you have to fit into it. That's because you believe God created you imperfectly, with all these imperfections, and now you have to fix it. See, that's exactly what happened here. God created you perfectly. He created your chitta perfectly, but you fail to accept it. You fail to admit it. Therefore, you have to go looking for happiness. In just the same way that when he created your body, he created it perfectly. But you are not happy with that. So then you have to go looking for ways and means in which you have to fill all those inadequacies. Those inadequacies were all born in your mind. Now just think about all the time that you have to spend removing hair from your bodies. Because simply because it's not presentable. Says who? I ask you, says who? Now I know what you're looking at. You're looking at me and you're thinking something. You're thinking, Swami Nuhans, what right do you have to ask us about shaving or taking out hair when you come like this every day with a bald head? I shave my head because it's easier. It's a convenience. Because when you grow your hair, you have to brush your hair, you have to comb your hair, you have to clean your hair, you have to wash your hair, you have to shampoo your hair, you have to use your conditioners on your hair. I don't have to do any of that. Ten minutes once a week or twice a week, and that's me done. But you can't say the same for yourselves. You have to go to the barber. You have to ask for this cut and that cut. High maintenance. Aren't you? Aren't those bodies of yours high maintenance? And, of course, you can't all be, you know, bald-headed because society does not expect that of you. They like you to have a good head of hair. They do. I mean, look at all the magazines. What does the picture of perfection look like? Long hair, silky hair, jet black and all sorts. I should be neatly parted, right, somewhere. Or combed back. These are all images that society has created, and you've been infiltrated by these indoctrinations. And once you've taken on these indoctrinations, now you have to maintain them. It's because all of those are comforts. None of this is happiness. Now going back to the barrel. This is the barrel full of good, clean, drinkable water. You are born with it. You are born with it. That is good, clean, drinkable water. In other words, chittas are born happy. But somewhere down the line, you come across someone who is an ignoble friend, a bad friend, someone who teaches you something that is not true. Someone who tells you that to be happy in life, you have to go after these comforts. So what you do is, they give you a barrel. This is their barrel. In this barrel, they have poison. This is poisoned. Well, this is poison. And what do you do if you take their word for it? You throw all the water that you have in your barrel. This is good, clean, drinkable water. You discard, you throw all that water, and in its stead, you fill up your barrel with their water. Actually, not their water, their poison. When you do that, you think, if I only took their what they have to offer me, that is, the you think it's water, but they're giving you poison. You think if I took what they have to offer me, because they say so, if I took what they have to offer me, I'll always be happy. You already had happiness with you, but you just didn't know that. Because someone played a practical joke on you. This was your battle when you were born. What was the practical joke? They told you, they indoctrinated you, that you don't have happiness to begin with. You have to go looking for happiness. That's where you spend 13 years of school. That's where you spend 3 years of university. That's where you spend another 10, 15, 20 years working on the career ladder, trying to improve yourself, progress yourself, take up all these jobs and progressions and all sorts, qualifications, all those things, trying to learn more so that you can earn more, so that you can eventually be happy. But you still haven't achieved that happiness. That is why you are in this room, I'm speaking to you, and you're listening to me. See, there's one of me and 200 of you. Agreed? There's one of me speaking and 200 of you listening. Who has the collective power of experience? Me or you? It's all of you. Because among you are teachers, engineers, lawyers, bankers, people who are married, people who are fathers, people who are mothers, people from all walks of life. And here's me with just one. I'm just one. How come 200 people are wrong and one person's right? Why are you here, by the way? You're here because what you know is right or what you know is wrong so far? What has life proven to you? What has life proven to you so far? What you know is right or what you know is wrong? What you know is wrong. How do you know that what you know is wrong? You're still not happy, but you have lots of comforts. Yeah? That's how you know. So you have come here on a Sunday morning to listen to a man who has nothing, not even the hair on his head. Two 200 of you have come here to listen to a man who has not a penny to his name, because you know one thing, he's right. What does that tell you about both of us? We are both after happiness, not comforts. Ultimately, we are all after happiness, not comforts. You are comfort rich, but happiness poor. I'm comfort poor, but I'm happiness rich. I'm talking to you. Who's the victor and who's the victim? I want you to open your eyes just as my teacher once helped me open my own eyes. As I always keep telling you, ladies and gentlemen, this is doable. All that is required is a change of attitude. That's all. You need to step out of this. Stop thinking that happiness equals comfort. It is not. Stop wasting your precious life going after comforts. This assumption that you have, this presumption that you have, this ignorance that you have, that comforts are going to bring you happiness, is total. Yes, that. You are the proof. You are living proof that what you know is wrong. Or at least what you have known is wrong. But that can all change from here on. What you have known is wrong. That's why you're still not happy. If I took your son away from you and took him to the monastery, will you be happy? Shush. You are today, madam, because today you have understood the Dhamma. But there'll be plenty of parents here who still not be happy for me to take their children away from them, because they believe that their comfort is their happiness. See, comforts. This is what you call in Sinhalese sampata. Daru sampata. You've never heard of Daru Satuta, have you? No. For the non-Sinhalese speakers, Darua is a child. Comfort is sampata. Satuta is happiness. So the saying goes that children are a comfort, but children are not happiness. That's what they say, the comfort of children, not the happiness of children. So if I take your child away from you and you are unhappy, that should teach you something. That your child was never happiness. Your child was only a comfort. Then it was your problem to think that happiness equals comfort. It's not. That's the veil of ignorance that you have to walk out of. Spread apart and walk out of. You know, if I don't take your child, you think your child is yours forever? If I don't take your child, who else will? Time will. Either give your child to me, or time will take him or her from you. You have no choice. You have no choice. You have to give up your child anyway. If you give your child to me, I can teach him how to be happy, with or without you. If you keep your child at home, your child is just like you. So your child thinks that happiness is comfort because you taught your child. Just as much as you think your happiness is your child thinks that his or her happiness is you, because that's what you told you. You taught your child. So he or she believes that happiness is comfort. As a result of which, if you keep your child at home, one day either he's going to go or you're going to go. And that's not me taking them from you. Time's going to take them from you. And then what's going to happen? Now your child is going to cry his eyes out. You can't stop that from happening. That's why what I'm trying to do is to take your child from you. Actually, if possible, take your child with you. Not from you. Take your child with you. Teach your child that happiness is not the same as comfort. Once you break this bond, now you realize that happiness is within you. Then that it becomes an unshakable happiness. That is unconditional happiness. That happiness cannot be taken from you. Even if the whole earth shatters under your feet, and the whole world crumbles down, your happiness will be unshakable. That's why Jesus says, "Come to me, all those who are weary and burdened, and I will set you free." Because he says, "I am the path, I am the truth, and I am life." He brings the truth to the world. Today people have dressed it up in all sorts of guises, but that's not his fault. He came into the world to teach the truth. Some people understood it, others didn't. That's all. I have made it one of my goals this year to spend more time to study the Bible. And I have found myself a very good teacher. Mr. Daniel, who is one of our Anagarikas. He comes from a family of devout Christians. Very devoted. Which makes him a treasure for people like myself. As soon as he's ordained, he has promised to start a Bible class at the monastery. And I've asked him to make me his first student. With his help, I'll be able to show you the Four Noble Truths in the Bible. Because there can't be two versions of the truth. He descends from a very good family. I was asking the other day, how's your father and mother think about you becoming a monk? And he says, well, my mother, She just loves me. She just wants me to be happy. So whatever I'm happy with, she's okay with that. But my father, he says, if I quote him right, he said, he's the most Christian person I know. But that's okay. There's nothing wrong with identifying yourself to be of any religion, because here we are not talking about religion. I'm trying to help inject the truth into whatever religion you believe in. So if you're a Hindu, then continue to be a Hindu. If you're a Muslim, continue to be a Muslim. If you're a Jain, then continue to be one. If you're a Christian, you can continue to be a Christian. But I'll tell you this much. If you're still unhappy, you still have yet to understand the essence of whatever your religion is. You still haven't understood it. That's not the religion's fault. That's your fault. Jesus Christ came into this world to teach people how to be happy. If you're not happy, that's not his fault. The fault is in you not having understood what he taught. Let me help you. Let me help you. The Prophet Muhammad came into this world to teach people how to be happy. You can't consider yourself to be a good Muslim and not be happy at the same time. You can't, right? If you consider yourself to be a good Muslim and then for your happiness you have to hurt other people, then that cannot be Islam. Then you are yet to understand the teachings of Islam. Let me help you. Let me help you. Give me a chance. So once I go through the Bible, I'll start going through the Quran. And I'll help you spot the Four Noble Truths within those words. Because the Four Noble Truths don't belong to anyone. The Four Noble Truths doesn't belong to Buddhism. If it did, then you must tell me what carbon belongs to. Or which religion hydrogen belongs to. Which faith or which belief system oxygen belongs to. Tell me that and I'll tell you what religion the Four Noble Truths belong to. It doesn't belong to religion. It's just the science of the mind. Minds are unhappy because they don't understand the truth. They're ignorant. With wisdom, minds can be free of sorrow, free of grief, free of fear. That is why the truth will set you free. For those of you who are born into a Buddhist family, consider yourselves very privileged. Because there is no initial friction that you sometimes have to come across when if you are born into another religion and someone tries to teach you Buddhist teachings, then there's initially some friction that you have to overcome. There's some objection that comes sometimes from yourself, sometimes from the society that you're in, sometimes from your community, right? Sometimes from your family. But if you are born into a Buddhist family, then you don't have that initial friction. Embrace that and think of that as a fantastic and a fabulous opportunity. But how many people born into Buddhist families actually understand Buddhism or Buddhist philosophy? Very few. Very few. Because one of the toughest things to do is to teach someone something they already know. Isn't it? That's one of the hardest things to do. I can teach Buddhism to a Muslim. I can teach Buddhism to a Hindu. I can teach Buddhism to a Christian or a Catholic or a Jain or a Jew. But one of the toughest things to do is to teach Buddhism to a Buddhist. Because they come and sit in the audience and they look at me with an expression on their face that speaks something like, okay, let's see whether what you know is right. So then I have to fight their egos. We do it out of compassion. We do it. We have to fight their egos. And we have to fight the initial resistance that they have. Because you come here having a pre-cooked meal and you want me to cook dinner for you. But if you came here with an empty plate and you're happy for me to cook your meal for you, you just bring the ingredients. That is your merits. You just bring the ingredients and let me be the chef. I'll cook your meal for you. Then there's no internal fight. There's no internal battle. That's why outside it says, for open-minded individuals. If you come here with preconceived ideas and you are adamant and you're stubborn and you're not willing to consider another alternative, it's very difficult. But you can't be like that, because if you had been, then you would not have been coming along for the last, 60 sermons or so. You've been coming along regularly because you have always been open-minded and you wanted to see the truth. This is the truth. So be happy, ladies and gentlemen, that you are born happy. Don't let people fool you. You know, this is my practical advice for you. Right? Because you take this home with you today, you need to live the rest of your week. As you drive out today onto the main street, you'll see various boards out there, advertising, billboards. It'll tell you, right, this is the burger that's going to make you happy. This is the dress that's going to make you happy. This is the trip that's going to make you, this is a holiday that's going to make you happy. Fly to the Maldives and you'll be happy. Fly to the Bahamas and you'll be happy. These are all comforts. If they have a price tag, remember it's a comfort. Please understand that that is a comfort. If it's anything external to you, it's a comfort. That's why you say it's comforting. His words are so comforting. Meaning, you thought that his words or her words brought you happiness. Her presence is so comforting. Meaning, she has to be there for you to be happy. How long can she do that? How long can she do that for? You're on a ticking time bomb every moment you say something like that or think something like that. I mean, you know, look at all you beautiful people. You have a wonderful smile on your face, but then you sat beside you is a person that you love. And then I look at you again and I think, ticking time bombs. Because if you're sat next to the person that you love, remember, misery is just a stone's throw away. Grief is just a step away. Sorrow is just a tick-tock away. If you are sat next to the person that you love, I know that you are still not happy. Forgive me, but that is the truth. Who am I sat next to? I'm sat next to no one. I don't mean physically. This is a metaphor. I'm sat next to no one because I'm sat next to the Dhamma. If you are sat next to someone, if you are sat next to someone, then I know that you are still not happy. Because from that person, you seek your happiness. They are simply a comfort. Their presence can be comforting, but they cannot give you happiness because happiness is not something that anyone can offer you. If you are sat next to your son, you're sat next to your daughter, you're sat next to your husband, you're sat next to your wife, you're sat next to your partner, you're sat next to your spouse, whoever, you're sat next to your grandmother, your grandfather, your boyfriend, your girlfriend. You take comfort in the fact that they're next to you, don't you? My God. You have no idea what's coming your way.
You are waiting for a tsunami. Because the tsunami of sorrow is coming your way, and it's coming right at you. There's only one relief. There's only one refuge. Understand the Dhamma. ASAP, do yourselves a favor and understand the Dhamma. In understanding the Dhamma, you will realize that no, it is not them that makes me happy. I can be happy on my own. But if today you have to hold someone's hand for you to be happy, if you need a caress, need someone to caress you to be happy, if you need someone to embrace you to be happy, if you need someone to kiss you on your forehead to be happy, there's a tsunami of grief coming your way. And it's a tsunami. It's not just a little wave. It's a tsunami. It'll destroy you. It'll shatter you. It'll break you. It'll tear you. It'll bring you down on your knees. Time and tide wait for no man. That's why your only refuge is the Dhamma. This is what the Dhamma will do for you. It will help you understand that your happiness is not something that you can get from someone else. See, I look at all of you. I love to see you happy, ladies and gentlemen. That's why I speak to you in this manner. Don't make false promises to the people sat either side of you. Don't look at your husband or your wife or your boyfriend or your girlfriend or your brother or your sister or your son or your daughter and tell them, Putta, I'll always make you happy. I'll forever make you happy. I'll forever keep you happy. That's a lie. You can't. Don't look at your partner and tell him or her, I'll always keep you happy, because you can't. Those are lies. If you want to keep them happy forever, give them the Dhamma. That's the only truth. Give them the Dhamma. Tell them how to be happy without you. Now that's powerful. Teach them how to be happy without you. That's powerful. Because one day you're going to leave them. Don't make promises you can't keep. How great it is that some children bring their parents here with them. Sometimes I see, children, they bring their 70-year-old, 80-year-old, sometimes even 90-year-old mothers and fathers. They can hardly walk, but they bring them to the sermons. Hats off to you. Because they have little time left to understand this. Because if they die without having understood the Dhamma, if they die thinking that their happiness comes from their children, from their property, from the wealth that they have acquired, from everything they have around them, it would be a miracle if they died sane. It would be a miracle. It would be a miracle if they died with their sanity intact. That's why people are scared of death. People are scared of death because they don't understand the Dhamma. Because they have so many things that they can't afford to leave behind. Why? Now you see the reason. Because they think happiness comes from comforts. And in here, you have everything that you have acquired in your whole life. Your parents, your sister, your siblings, your children, your family, your property, your wealth, your status, your accolades, your recognition, your rewards, your professions. All of these things are in here, these comforts. And if you believe that your happiness comes from them, then on the day you close your eyes for the last time, this you're going to have to leave behind. You can't take any of this with you because you didn't come into this world with any of this. Here's what you came into this world with. This. I rest my case, ladies and gentlemen. You have no other refuge. It's either the Noble Triple Gem or nothing at all. The jury's out. It's either the Noble Triple Gem or nothing at all. Prove me wrong, and I keep to my word from last week. I will come home and I will slave for you one whole year. You won't have to pay me a penny. I'll wash your dog for you. I'll wash your car for you. I'll cook all your meals for you. I'll clean your house for you. I'll heat the water for you. I'll even keep your husband company. I'll do the shopping for you. I'll wash all your dirty laundry for you. I'll do all that for you for one whole year for wasting your time here once a week. Prove me wrong. Show me you have another refuge other than the Noble Triple J. Other than understanding the Dhamma, show me you have one other refuge. Show me. Convince me. You know I'm not a fool. Convince me. I'm happy to accept any reasonable argument. I'm a logical man. I'm not an idiot. I can understand what you say. So come and convince me. That whatever philosophy you subscribe to until you came across the Dhamma was the path to happiness. Convince me. Convince me that your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your husband, your wife can make you happy. Come on. Convince me. Convince me that the good boy that you're looking for to give your daughter's hand in marriage is going to keep her happy. Come on. Parents. If that is your dream, to marry your son off, your daughter off, to a good boy, to a good girl, in the hope that they're going to keep your beloved child happy for the rest of their lives, convince me that that is true. I'll let you speak for a whole hour and not say a word, just so you can finish your arguments. And at the end of it, I'll ask you one simple question. Are you, having done that? In the face of truth, everything else false. That's why I keep on asking you, are you doing what you are supposed to be doing with your lives? Here's how I spend my life. I have happy chittas. I don't spoil them. I don't spoil them. We have 170 young children at the monastery between the ages of 6 and 18. 170, and it's a growing number. They're not my children, they're your children. But now they have become my children. And here's what we teach them. Dear child, you need not go after happiness. Happiness is yours. And they have understood. But we teach them how to tie their shoelaces. We teach them how to boil some water. We teach them how to cross the street. Because these are things that one needs to live a comfortable life. Yes. The basic necessities. You need to know. You need to understand. You need to learn language so you can communicate. Yes. You need to be able to make a convincing argument. Yes. So you can help other people understand the Dhamma as well. Yes, we do that. We teach 13 languages at the monastery. Why? So we can take the message of the truth all over the world. And there are those among you who help with that. That's why I always say, don't worry about my arms round. Don't worry about what falls into my arms bowl. Because if I eat today, I'll be hungry again tomorrow. You can't stop that from happening, can you? Can you? You cook the nicest food that you can afford and bring it and offer it to my arms bowl. When I come on arms round to you, cook the nicest food that you can afford, the most expensive food that you can afford, cook it the best you can, take 6 hours to cook it, and bring it and offer it to my arms bowl. Tomorrow morning I'll be back here saying I'm hungry. See, the best chef in the world can't stop me from becoming hungry. That's why I say, leave meat aside. Dedicate yourself to the sasana. Because the sasana is a mission. There's nothing you can feed me that will stop me from becoming hungry, but I can give you the Dhamma that will stop you from becoming sad. That will stop. Once and for all. And you don't have to wait until you die. This you only have to give once. Food you have to give every day. Let's not worry about food. Don't worry about the robe I'm clad in. One day you'll see it's torn, the other day I'll patch it up. Don't worry about that. I just need something to cover myself from the four basic elements, that's all. Don't worry about that. If you want to serve me, if you're grateful for what we have done here together over the last however many weeks, serve the sasana. Because the sasana is what served me. If you care about me, care about what I care about. Once again, if you care about me, care about what I care about. The sasana is what has given me this freedom. The Sri Sambuddha Sasana, the truth. The doctrine of the truth, the philosophy of the truth, the mission of the truth. That's what has given me this freedom. There are 175 children who have come looking for solace. Along with their parents, we look after them. We feed them. We give them shelter. But those are all very temporary things. We do them because we have to do them, not because we like doing them. But here's what we like to do, give them the Dhamma. But every man comes with a body. I wish we could let the parents keep the bodies and send us just the minds. Because that's what mothers want, right? As long as I have my child with me, I'm happy. So you keep the body, send us the mind. We don't want the bodies. Honestly, we don't want the bodies. The mother likes to hold the child's cheeks and go, oh, cute, 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 cuddly. We don't want to do any of that. I don't want the cute and cuddly faces. I just want to heal their minds. But unfortunately, you can't just take the mind. It comes with the body. So when it comes with the body, we have to make a bed for them to sleep in. We have to put a roof above their heads. And when the ceiling starts to leak, we have to go fix that. We have to give them water. And if they're ill, we have to boil the water. When they're ill, we have to give them their medicines. And we have to teach them. Don't worry about my arms. Don't worry about that. The Buddha has taught me how to find food. He gave me an arm, so I said, go begging, and they'll give you. So I can do that. I can survive. Don't worry about me. Love the sasana. Take care of the sasana. I'm doing what I can to look after the sasana. I've given my life to the sasana, ladies and gentlemen. There's nothing more left to give. I've given it all. Every word I speak today, I speak on behalf of the sasana. Every breath I take on behalf of the sasana. Every mile I walk on behalf of the sasana, because the sasana is my father, it is my mother. It is what has taught me how to truly love every human being the same. I only knew how to love one woman, one man, one child, one mother, one father, one friend. That's all I knew how to love. I was so constrained, so restricted. My world was so small. Because I was so self-focused. That's all I could see. Me and my people. Me and my people. That's all I could see. But the sasana opened my eyes. And it showed me that that was just a figment of my own imagination. There is no me and my people. There's all of us. So don't worry about my arms. Don't worry about whether I have a roof above my head. Because the Buddha has told me how to survive. He's taught me how to survive. He said, if people don't give you shelter, then go under a tree and take shelter. I can do that. I can do that. I'm a grown man. I can look after myself. Don't worry about me. Look after the sasana. Because the sasana, one man can't look after by themselves. It requires everyone. To whatever extent you have benefited from the sasana, to that extent you look after the sasana. one looks after their mother to the extent to which they understand how much their mother have dedicated themselves to them. If you love your mother so much, that's because you know how much your mother has done for you. The sasana is my mother. It is a sasana that has helped me today to help my biological mother as well. A woman who was about to go to the four great hells. A man who was going to go to the four great hells. Today the sasana has helped me to help them. And I talk to them. I share with them the Dhamma. I help them to understand that their connection, their unnatural bonds that they have towards me, their attachment that they have to me and their children and their property and whatever else they might be attached to is going to spell their demise. And so I help them today to understand that they are simply a mind, a chitta. That's why the sasana is the only refuge. As I say, there are people among you who do a lot for the sasana. There are those who introduce those people who can help the sasana. There are those who come and share their knowledge. There are among you some who are teachers. Languages that you know, you come and teach our monks, our anagarikas, our little children, so that they can take the Dhamma to the rest of the world. That is you looking after the sasana. You need not worry about me. There are those who come up and ask, Swami, what can we do to prosper the sasana so that we can all benefit from it? What can we do for the children? Once again, don't look after me, don't worry about me. I'm nothing. I'm here because of the sasana. So if you want more like me, what should you look after? If you want more like me, what should you feed? If I am a golden egg, to borrow the metaphor, what should you feed? The goose. Feed the goose. Don't worry about the golden egg, because many more will come. Many more will come. But if the goose dies, then what happens? No more golden eggs. And besides, that is the way that you can earn lots of merits. That's why I always say, don't focus your givings to any one individual. Because the merits you earn by giving to an individual are slim, almost next to none, compared to when you make an offering to the Sri Sambuddha Sasana. Because the Sambuddha Sasana is not the Buddha, it's not an individual. It is the mission of healing hearts and mending minds. That's what the Sasana is. It's the mission of healing hearts and mending minds. Isn't that what we've been doing ever since we started coming to Gateway? Healing hearts and mending minds. You know, that's what this hall has been given for. Every Sunday we do this. They've never charged a penny. If they did, I wouldn't be able to afford it. You might. But today, you need not worry about it. You can drive your cars, you can park it there. There are officials out there, security people out there who look after your vehicles, so that you need not worry about that either. You come in here, the chairs are laid out, you get a refreshment here as well. You're sat here in comfort. Can you hear the fans? The fans are too loud, aren't they? No, because there are no fans. They have given you the best that they can, because they want you to understand the Dhamma, learn the Dhamma, realize the truth. They've given you everything that they can. What you can do for the sasana will differ from person to person. For someone it might be a carrot. That's okay, if that's what you can. Not a gold carrot, maybe it's a carrot. Maybe all you can do is a spoonful of rice. If that's what you can, then that's what you can. That's okay. Whatever it is, what I'm saying is, that spoonful of rice, rather than being concerned about whether you put it into my alms bowl, give it to the sasana. Because if the sasana prospers, you and I have hope. If the sasana dies, there's no point in me being alive. And like I said, there are some individuals among you who are well connected. There are people who know people who can get things done. Do for the sasana. Introduce them to the sasana so that not only the sasana can benefit, but they can benefit as well. Because if someone comes to serve the sasana, then of course the sasana doesn't wash their hands and look away. You always benefit from the sasana. What you get from the sasana is a trillion times more than what you put into the sasana. Always. I've only had to put in my life. What did I get back? I put in one lifetime. What did I get back? I got back Nibbana. I put in a lifetime of happiness and I got back an infinite amount of happiness. It's always like that. The sasana never keeps debts. It always repays. So this is the sasana, ladies and gentlemen. Every day I will share with you a little bit of what the sasana entails. So, first and foremost, do yourselves a favor and try and understand this. Do as much merits as you possibly can, because your merits will pave the path to you understanding the Dhamma. Not everyone will understand this, because not everyone will have the merits to understand it. That is the only difference. So the more merits you have, that is the currency that you will have to expend to understand the Dhamma. The more merits you have, the more you will understand the Dhamma. And the more you understand the Dhamma, the more you will realize that happiness is not something you have to seek from the outside world. When that day arises, comes in your life, then you will not be afraid of shutting your eyes. You won't be scared of closing your eyes. You won't be scared of your ears going deaf. You won't be scared of the day your five senses stop working. You need your five senses so that comforts could keep coming to you. See, eyes with which you see your comforts, ears with which you listen to your comforts, nose with which you smell your comforts, tongue with which you taste your comforts, touch with which you feel your comforts. See? That's why you need your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and you're so attached to them. But the day you realize that happiness is not something that comes from the outside world, then you become independent. Then when your five senses shut down, whichever day they choose to do so, you're okay with that. You're free. That's the freedom we speak of. Ultimate freedom. Does that make sense to everyone? So don't worry about me. I'm just one man, just one life. There are many like me, and there are many better than me, who will walk in these paths and who will sit on this chair and who will keep on delivering the Sri Sambuddha Sasana. The day I'm not here, there'll be many more who will come and take my seat and continue this service. So you need not worry about me. Just make sure you keep an eye on the machine that creates people like me. Make sure the machine is always well oiled and is running smoothly. Because if the machine shuts down, then there won't be people like me. So don't worry about the fruit. Take care of the tree. If you look after the tree will always bear fruit. One fruit will rot. That's okay. Don't worry about that. The storms will come and take some of it. The animals will come and take some of it. The children in the village will come and take some of it. The worms will eat some of it. Time will take some of it. But that's okay. As long as the tree bears fruit, then everyone will have something to eat. So, look after the tree. And that tree is the Sri Sambuddha Sasana. The Buddha planted the seed. The Buddha planted the seed. Today, it's a massive oak tree. Or it's a massive apple tree, if you like. It's a massive tree. And when I say, long live the Sri Sambuddha Sasana, long live that tree, so that fruits can be born for now and for time to come. Because you will one day become a fruit on that tree. For that to happen, the tree has to survive. This is the tree that taught me that happiness is to be found within. It's not something that comes from the outside world. It's 11:30. Before we conclude, a few weeks ago, your noble friend, Mr. Daniel, from Germany, he had to stay back and not come with me because his Anagarika program, towards the end of the Anagarika program, they have a more intensive program for the last couple of months. It's called the Pandu program. Basically, they do everything like monks. So they really get into monk life. So he walked up to me and said, "Swaminand sir, please can you speak to the Rajagirians and offer to them my gratitude? It is because of them I have been able to earn so much merits by taking you there, and the Swaminand is there, by helping the people who come there, by welcoming them and talking to them and answering their questions and making them feel part of the family. Please can you do that on my behalf, and please can you tell them that I will not be able to come for the next few weeks," and so on. I said, okay, I'll tell that. But I never said a word to you, right? Because I knew this day was coming. So I said I would, but I didn't. Today he has brought with him his mother and his sister and her friend who have come here for his ordination, which will happen soon. So I'm sure Mr. Daniel has a message that he might like to share with all of you, and I'd like to offer this opportunity, extend this opportunity to him to share a few words with you. And if he likes you enough, he might just invite you to his ordination ceremony. Over to you.
Teran Sarnai. I am so happy to see so many people. I can remember when I came here the last time, we still had the chairs in the back, and the room was not as filled as today. And maybe there are many people who don't even know me, but I also can see when I came here, I see many, many faces that I've seen over all these months that I've been coming, and all these faces, the moment they saw me, were smiling, and I felt that happiness within me. I also felt the same happiness of seeing all of you again, and I'm sorry if I didn't have the chance to announced that I was not able to come anymore for the next few months, but then I have the good opportunity to speak to you today. And for some reason or another, when I was walking to Amadasana Teruskuti in the morning, I had a feeling that this was going to happen, although at that time we didn't have any plans, or I wasn't being told, so I didn't have any preparation for what should I say and how should I say it, or anything like that. But still, I'm so grateful. And so, first of all, what I wanted to say that every time when I'm going to the Kuti, the small house where Amanasana Deva, my teacher, is living, or when I'm leaving that from there, in my mind there is always this thought that I don't know if ever in my journey in samsara over these many years and lives I ever had the fortune to be so close to a person, and with that person comes the whole community. But I'm just taking as a representative, such a teacher, and how blessed I am to have this opportunity. Maybe I had these opportunities, but certainly I didn't make use of that as much as I am trying to do this life and this time. And I always tell myself that, and in the same way, we all, I think we can all share this feeling that you're coming here every week and you're having this enormous blessing to be here, listen to these words, follow the advice and change your lives. And my life was a good life from a mundane point of view when I was in Germany. I had a great mother and great siblings, great sister, and we had, there was nothing to complain. But certainly I had the highest ambition I would have had is to win a Nobel Prize, which is nothing you can ever be sure to achieve. And even then, the amount that by which you can actually help and change the world is rather limited. And the more I understood the Dhamma, the more I understood that these changes are rather insignificant, helping someone by doing the normal science. But because of my teachers, I have been able to, now I don't know how much of an impact I can make. Maybe it's still a small impact, because even the Buddha couldn't do everything. But I consider my life very blessed in that way, having these teachers and having the chance to help and heal so many people all around the world. And this is a path of journey of transformation, or a path of is happening step by step. So the last year I was living in the monastery and living there and learning, as well as coming here, doing a lot of merits. You all pushed me as well. You gave me the big chance to give to you, or to give something to you, to all of you who want to be happy and to want to attain the Nibbana and to help others as well as much as you can, because we can. I can see that every time you're here, and I could also see that today with my mother and my siblings, the way that you have talked to them, the way that you have made them comfortable, and I have not seen that anywhere else. So I'm my heart is very, very joyful when I think about this. And so now I invited my mother and my sister and her friend to come to my ordination. So this is my family in this life, but in the same way, it would be it wouldn't be fair not coming here and inviting all my mothers and fathers and sisters that I have had, maybe not in this life, but in this journey of samsara. I'm sure we have all made the journey together in some way or another with the same goal. So in that same way, I want to invite you all to witness the ordination ceremony and be part of. So I want to give you the chance to acquire a lot of merits by coming, by rejoicing in that. Every small bit of well-wishing can, it's not going to affect me as much as it can affect you, and we are all part of one mission. We all, I think, can realize how much we can change, or we can make an impact on our surrounding and on other people in the whole world. So we are united in that, and we are all trying our best to make it possible. So that's more or less everything I have to say. So the ordination ceremony will happen in August, in August 17, on a Saturday. So I'd be very happy to see as many people and recognize as many faces as possible on that day. And I'll be happy to speak to you after the ordination ceremony, or at least, I think, in the day after I will be here. So thank you, much merits, for giving me the opportunity to be part of this community, be part of this mission, and learn from you in the way that you help others, in the way that you really want to make a change in other people's life, in your life, by coming here, by listening attentively, and in every small word and every small thing you do, as we have always tried to prepare the sermons, we always feel that there's not much that we really need to do, because so many people around us come and take our work and carry the suitcase or set up the lights, and that is only the people who we get to interact with, not speaking about the people who create the decoration, who organize everything and do the things behind the scenes, making the WhatsApp group and making sure that everyone can profit as much as possible from this. So, yes, that's it. Much merits, and I really hope to see all of you. And before I forget, when I told my mother about this in the sermon, that I have that now I have to speak, she also told me that she wants to speak. Now she's been listening to the sermon, and she has talked with some of you before. She wants to say a few words, although her English might not be as perfect as mine. In any case, I can translate the words in English. So I'm sure that you are happy to hear from her as well about her experience from today.
Good morning together. My name is Jolanta. It's a Polish name because I'm originally from Poland. And I'm very happy to be here. Yes, I'm Catholic. Wahrscheinlich wissen.
Okay. I'll translate. I'm a Catholic woman. And in Poland, 90% of the people. So Poland is a neighboring country of Germany. And in Poland, 90% of the people are Catholic Christians. I know that in Sri Lanka also there are some Catholics living. And before the sermon, I also met a Catholic person. I came down to Sri Lanka to see whether me, so my son, was actually happy doing a and my daughter as well as her friend and me, now we are in Sri Lanka and for around 5 days since Wednesday. We had been able to experience 2 days in the monastery during that time. And I have found out that we Christians are the perfect Buddhists.
Warum?
Why? So before I used to come here, I used to talk with my son, with me, about Buddhism and about all these kind of topics. But yesterday when I joined to the Dakineo program, the Parahara and the procession that was happening, I used to see many Christian symbols in the event.
Ich sah zum Beispiel diese Fahnen vorne, die Blumen, die die Kinder in den Händen trugen, und
Okay. For example, the things that I used to see was the at the front of the Padahada, there is these banners with the, some stanzas written on it. So I saw these things, and I saw the children walking with flowers in their hands, as well as the folded hands, which is something as Christians, when we are praying, then also we are folding our hands in a similar way.
Ich fühlte mich wie bei einer Leichenprozession.
I felt just like in our Catholic Church, we have a, I don't know the name of that that holiday, but on that day also, in we are used to have a procession in the village, and I felt just like there. And that time, at our the way we do it in that procession, the children are putting the throwing the flowers on the ground. A feast, yes. Yeah, that.
Dann habe ich gestern gesehen, wie auf diesem Stoff, der da aufgerollt war, da waren zwei Personen, die zwei Besen, und die haben die ganze Zeit gekehrt.
And then I saw also in the Padahada that on the pavade that was rolled out before the monks, there was there were two men who were having a broom, and they were brooming to the outside symbolically.
Ich versuche Buddhismus zu verstehen, aber in dem Moment dachte ich an unsere Aufräumen. Also unsere Seele ausräumen, reinigen, uns von den bösen Taten befreien. Das geschieht bei uns über Jesus. Hmm.
So I'm trying to understand Buddhism, and but when I saw that, when I saw that these two men with the brooms, I felt like something like our soul or our conscience to clear to make clean our soul, our inside, our mind, whatever. My conscience, my moral compass, my conscience to clean that. And and we are doing that by giving that, or we throwing it off to Jesus or to the, yeah, to Jesus. In the Bible it is written that whatever good you are giving, it will return to you sevenfold. So in the same way, what we call as merits. And I think that whoever is living as a real Christian, I think that that person must. I think that we as Christians have taken a lot of things from Buddhism because it's an older religion, but I think we have taken many customs and traditions. Are originally from there.
Is it not
And in my WhatsApp stages, I always use something that we in Germany take as something that's more as a Buddhist, coming from Buddhist background, which is that in the calmness or in the tranquility or the there is a kind of a power in there. there's a big power coming from that place. And I always, my profile picture, there's, it's always written, I'm a free spirit. So I, and I'm born in the year 1964.
I'm 60 years old.
Now I'm 60 years old. I just turned 60 years old. Yeah. And because of the sermon today, I changed my WhatsApp status as happiness means being in the present. The words that he has used. For me, that is the key takeaway from this sermon.
Any other mothers who are 60 and still have their sons at home? Shame on you.
It's better if he's here. She's talking about me. It's better if he's here because he's happy here.
So.
Ich möchte mich ganz herzlich bedanken für meinen Sohn, der hat mich aufgenommen
I want to say thank you to all of you because you have hosted and you have taken and you have accommodated my son very happily and very gladly and very kindly. And every and all I can see is very friendly, very kind, very warm-hearted people. I'm so happy to know that now I am having such a big and lovely family, and that is much better than just having a mother and a father alone. Thank you very much.
It takes everyone to make a mother feel like that. She gave up her son, who left her. Her sister gave up her brother, who left her. The father gave up his son, who left him. And he went looking for the truth. I'm reminded of Prince Siddhartha, who left his family behind and he went looking for the truth. And then ultimately he found the truth, didn't he? And having found the truth, what did he do? He took the message, he took the truth back to his family. So today what you have witnessed is the same. You have all made this possible, ladies and gentlemen. And Mr. Daniel shared something with me this morning, and I asked him whether it would be okay for me to share it with everyone. He was happy to. But I said, the moment I say this, you had better warn your mother because she might have to cancel all her plans of traveling around Sri Lanka. Then Mr. Daniel told me that someone among you, a few of you, had really wanted to make his mother and his sister and friend feel at home and welcome. And to do so, they had actually invited them over for lunch at their home as well. Never met before. Total strangers. But they wanted to make his mother feel that she has a family here. So someone among you has already made that invitation, and whoever it is, I want to say thank you, because you have really gone the extra mile to make his family feel that they have a home here. so that there will always be a reason for them to come back. Now that we have done our work with the brother, our Anagarika Mahatmyas are already working on the sisters. You have till the 17th. Because we hope that Daniel's mother will also one day become a Sila Sravika. She's already considering it. We have managed to do that already. But let's see. But we are doing what we can. We're doing what we can because we care about everyone the same. Because we don't see Sri Lankans, we don't see Germans, we don't see Buddhists or Christians, we don't see men or women, we don't see people of religion, we don't see people of race, creed, or social status. All we see are chittas. Chittas that were born happy. Chittas that were born happy and that deserve to live and die happy. Ignorance is the only evil that we have. And that's the evil against which we wage war. That's our fight. That's our battle. And that is the sasana. I alone could not have made Mr. Daniel feel at home. I could not have done all that by myself. Yes, he might have heard a sermon on YouTube or wherever he might have found it, and that might have piqued his interest. He might have subscribed and he might have continued to listen. But when he arrived in Sri Lanka, very soon, he found a home away from home. And that I could not have done by myself. Everyone at the monastery, all our monks, all the Anagarikas, the Anagarika Mahatmyas, as well as all our devotees, all of you, it takes a whole village to raise a child, and that saying is so true. So we were able to give him, at least in a small way, the love and the affection that his family showed him when he was there with them. And that is when he considered staying and considering this his home. So once again, for all that you have done to help Mr. Daniel complete an entire year of the Anagarika period at the monastery and to develop himself and prepare himself to his upcoming ordination, which is on the 17th of August, I wish to thank you all for what you have done on behalf of the Sambuddha Sasana. So I would also extend the same invitation on behalf of the monastery. So the 17th of August, which is a Saturday, so you're all welcome. If you can be there, I think that would be a great strength goes to him as well as his family. You can bring your friends along as well and make it a day to remember for the rest of your lives. Now, hopefully you haven't forgotten all the things we've talked about and got carried away. So this is what's going to set you free. If this is what set Mr. Daniel free, then this is what's going to set you free. Okay? So this is the path that we must all take to our liberation. Please don't forget that. Please contemplate on that and practice until the very end. Right. Let's do the merit transfer and bring today's sermon to a close. Next week is the day that you have, the Sunday that you have permitted for me to go out on alms round, because next week is the first Sunday of the month. So, please allow Swami Mahansay to do as you have promised you would. So, you will not need to bring any alms food next week. Right? So, we will go on foot to those people who are more needy than you. The people who need a lot more merits than you, because your merits have guided you here. Their merits are so little that they're still at home. Then you come to the Swaminarayan, they still need the Swaminarayan to come to them. That's the difference. But that is the gift of giving. You can enjoy and embrace and rejoice in that. Right. Let's do the merit transfer and bring the sermon to a close. First and foremost, then, let us all take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Swaminarayan to deliver the sermon, listening to the sermon, and creating a conducive environment for all to practice the path in comfort. Let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to all the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer this merits to my teacher Guru Swami Nuhansi, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us take a moment to transfer this merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. Let us also transfer this merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery who, for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcoming obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends and our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, and as well as everyone and anyone who's helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who passed away in our name, our forefathers and our ancestors, our loved ones, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts that we do and to be able to practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer these merits to the members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who have lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us. With an abundance of compassion and gratitude, let us transfer all the merits that we have acquired to all of them. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahatharanin Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnendetva dvesha ginnendetva moha ginnendetva nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva
Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita tara vetna mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita tara vetna Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita tara vetna Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita tara vetna Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivansapa labeva Nivansapa labeva Nivansapa labeva Tunrani suvisi ananta mahaguna belen Silu loka silu satyoma Nibbana paramasukhen sukhita taravetva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu